Mike Malevsky here at Radio Free Palmer. It's my great pleasure to have on the phone Cliff Levy, who has a very interesting story. He happens to be coming, he is in Alaska and is going to be talking about issues associated with Russia. And I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Cliff. What is your present position? What do you do?
Great. Well, I just want to first begin by saying I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be in Alaska. And I'm thrilled to be on your show to take some questions and sort of discuss various aspects of my background. I'm currently an editor at the New York Times in based in New York City. I'm one of the newsroom leaders. I oversee, my title is assistant masthead editor, but I basically oversee all our digital platforms. I oversee our website and I oversee our mobile apps and a lot of our digital presence online. But before I was doing that, I was a reporter for a long time, and then I became a foreign correspondent. I was based in Russia for 5 years. At that time, I was Moscow bureau chief, and I just delved extensively into what was happening there in the post-Soviet era. I was there from 2006 to 2011.
Okay. And you were primarily in Moscow?
Yeah. I spent a year living in St. Petersburg, and I spent 4 years living in Moscow. Of course, I traveled all around the Soviet Union very extensively, from Kyrgyzstan, which is right near, which is in Central Asia, all the way over to Estonia, which is now part of the EU. So the breadth of the former Soviet Union is kind of astonishing.
Yes, I was fortunate back in the day to do some travel myself, starting with a camping trip way before you were there. When Russia was the Soviet Union at that time. And I have memories of the Georgian military high road, a nasty road going into the Kavkaz, and the rest of it. But the size was absolutely amazing. We think of Alaska being large, but Russia has that quality too.
Yes, I mean, it's not only the size, Mike, it's also the diversity, the ethnic diversity of the former Soviet Union. You know, one of the largest Muslim cities outside of the Arab world or the Muslim world is in Moscow. Moscow has, depending on who counts it, anywhere from 1 to 2 million Muslim residents. And the former Soviet Union itself, it extends so far across the planet that, as I said, if you look at Estonia, which is very close to Finland and ethnically and culturally on one end, and then if you look at some of the states of Central Asia, they are very close to Afghanistan and India and China on the other end. It's pretty striking. It's pretty startling when you actually kind of delve into that. And, in Soviet times, they were all under one banner. They were all under one government, all ruled by Moscow.
Right, right. So you arrived in Moscow with some preparation, I'm guessing. I'm curious, if you reflect back after spending 5 years there and you had your family there, kids in school and all, what was the biggest takeaway of a change in your impression about the place over that 5 year period?
Well, I think for a lot of people from my generation or older, their images of Moscow and Russia in general were really hardened by the Cold War and certain Cold War themes or even cliches, People always knew about the lack of consumer goods in the former Soviet Union, that it was very hard to find, fresh fruits and vegetables or blue jeans or electronics or things like that. Russia has starkly, dramatically changed since then. I mean, in a place like Moscow, you can pretty much get anything you can get in Anchorage or New York or anywhere in the free world or in the world in general. Russia has become very much a consumerist society. And it actually gives you, once you see that and you recognize that, it really gives you an insight into the popularity of Vladimir Putin. When I first got to Russia, I went to Kia, the Kia store in St. Petersburg, outside St. Petersburg. And I also went to a couple of what they call hypermarkets, huge supermarkets in St. Petersburg. And they were just mobbed with people, and they were packed with every kind of consumer good you could want. And I suddenly had this kind of aha moment, and I said to myself, that's what's really going on here. To some extent, and I don't want to exaggerate this, but to some extent, people care deeply about the fact that they have now, they are now in the former Soviet Union or Russia in particular, able to join the rest of the world in enjoying some of the comforts that have, that were long available in the West. And it's not just consumer goods, it's also travel. One of the things I found kind of fascinating is when I was there, how often Russians travel to resorts in Thailand or India or at that time Egypt or Turkey. And they, you know, they could escape the harsh Russian winter, jump on a charter plane, and spend a week at a hotel on the Mediterranean or, you know, in Thailand. And that, that meant tremendous amount to them. And to some extent, they were able to overlook some of the crackdowns that Putin undertook, in part because he kept raising the standard of living of everyone. I mean, you know, that I think is something that, that it's important for Americans to understand. I think Americans are sometimes baffled by the popularity of Vladimir Putin. But, you know, if you've lived in a country that for so long was deprived of so much, and all of a sudden it all becomes available to you, well, that's the thing that you're really focused on. So people are often very inwardly turned. They're turned away from kind of civil society or democracy, and they're focused on just ensuring that they have kind of quality lives to themselves, quality personal lives, they have apartments, they have consumer goods.
So there have been two reports that I have noted coming out of Russia recently. Most recently was a focus on the development of submarines, the military in Russia. And the second one is related to the oil situation. The state of Alaska is finding itself in something of a deficit because of the low price of oil. And Russia, because of its dependence upon oil as a way to earn money, seems to also be in something of a bind in terms of its budgeting, et cetera. Would you comment about either or both of those?
Yeah, I mean, Russia is facing serious challenges. It's an economy that is largely dependent upon oil exports, gas exports, other natural resource exports. And it now joins this kind of pantheon of countries, whether it's Venezuela or Iran or Saudi Arabia itself, that are facing serious budget problems because the price of oil has you know, dramatically dropped. And, of course, I don't have to tell that to Alaskans. I mean, Alaska's state budget is obviously to some extent in the same position. I mean, Alaska's facing, as I understand it, you know, a budget crisis in part because the price of oil has plunged. In Russia, you know, that's an even more serious problem because it's the federal government that we're talking about, and Putin has really pledged a lot of money to reinvigorate the Russian military, which in the post-Soviet era just fell on terribly hard times. I think it's important for people to understand that for Russia, you know, which is the heir to the Soviet Union, the collapse after 1991 was just a terrible, terrible blow. It was a terrible blow to the country's prestige. It was a terrible blow to this country's sense of itself. You know, you can imagine that throughout the post-World War II era, Russia or the Soviet Union was essentially one of the two big powers, and it really strode across the world stage as a dominant presence. And then the Soviet Union collapses, and Russia is considered to be almost a charity case. That was just terribly difficult for the Russian leadership, for the Russian people to really kind of wrap their brains around. And so essentially what happened was when Putin came into office, he said, we're no longer going to take that we're going to actually flex our might. We're going to make Russia something again. And I think the Russian people responded very positively to that. They did not like it that that they were being perceived, that their nation was being perceived as a kind of a weakling on the world stage.
Right.
Putin's efforts to build up the Russian military are part of that. I mean, Putin knows, obviously, he will never be able to really challenge, leaving aside the nuclear issue, which is obviously a huge one, but in terms of conventional weaponry or conventional forces, he will never be able to challenge the Americans and NATO. I mean, the Americans and NATO vastly outspend Russia. They have vastly more sophisticated technology. Having said that, there are certain things that Russia can do that will really allow the country to kind of puff up its chest and say, yes, we're really taking it to the U.S. The submarine issues is one of those. You know, they're starting to patrol in the North Sea, around the Arctic, and the Mediterranean much more aggressively than they ever did before. And again, that's not to start a war. That's not to, you know, really provoke the U.S. or NATO. But it is definitely intended to show that Russia is back on the scene.
Okay. Well, we have in Alaska a member of the U.S. Olympic Committee and an Olympian herself, Nina Kempel, who we've had talk about the Olympics in Russia. She attended there, and it was very insightful because there was considerable discussion about whether Russia was going to be able to pull this off, whether Putin was doing something that really drained from the rest of the economy, et cetera. And yet, in talking with Nina, my sense was it actually came off pretty well. Any comments about the Olympics there in the Sochi area?
I mean, I think the Olympics themselves came off pretty well, but I think my understanding is they spent a tremendous amount of money, and now they're in the place, is not really benefiting from it. I mean, that's to some extent the legacy of many Olympics,
right,
where the government spent a huge amount of money and nothing comes of it after the Olympics. There was a lot of hope in Moscow that all the spending that the government was doing, that Putin was doing, would really invigorate Sochi, which is this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful city in southern Russia. It doesn't seem to be. I mean, they want to turn Sochi into a real travel hub, but you know there are much, much bigger problems that the Russian tourist industry has. I mean, the biggest of which is that you can't just travel to Russia; you have to get a visa.
Right.
And so it's hard to imagine them actually getting a huge influx of tourists from Europe, for example, until they can really deal with the visa issue.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your willingness to take some time and talk about Russia and these various features. Let's switch to why you're here. You've come to Alaska, not just on a whim, and talk a little bit about what you are doing here.
So I'm speaking at the Alaska Press Club. They have an annual conference, and talking a little bit about the digital transition that the New York Times has undergone and that the journalism industry in general is undergoing. You know, as you probably know, over the last 20 years, we've made this pretty radical transition from being almost entirely based in the print newspaper, moving to the internet, on the web, on the computer, now on the phone. And so it's been a pretty wrenching but fascinating transition for the New York Times and for the industry in general, with a lot of successes and a lot of failures. I'm here to kind of impart some of that wisdom to my colleagues, journalists in Alaska, and to kind of talk to them a little about the transitions that they're undergoing and how I can be helpful to them.
Ah, very good. Yes. And the Times has been, we follow that. In fact, I use much of the digital accessed information from the New York Times here. It's been very, very helpful and works pretty well. And of course, our own local newspapers and obviously stations, our own included, are continually seeing how we blend the normal FM broadcast, audio, et cetera, with our web presence and other modalities. So in addition to that, you'll be out here in Palmer, as I understand.
Yes, I'm excited to come out to Palmer to speak a little bit, to check out the locality and the locale. I arrived on Thursday morning, and I've already been driving a little bit. I was at the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center yesterday, and I'm in Anchorage right now. I'm walking around, and it's kind of, I find the scenery just stunning and gorgeous. Unfortunately, the weather is not so great today, but it was amazing yesterday, and I just love walking around.
Right. My wife and I drove from Anchorage back to the valley, and that was, in the evening, a classical sky, incredible color and all the rest. And the projection is for some more sun. We won't be all gray during your stay here. So you'll be out here on a Sunday afternoon at Farside Books, mm-hmm. I understand.
Yes,
Okay.
Excited to talk a little bit about my experience in Russia, my experience as a journalist now, and you know, meet some folks, answer some questions. I'm really looking forward to it.
So very often you're introduced as an award-winning journalist. How did it come about that you were able to win awards, other than doing a very good job?
I mean, I have I've done a lot of different things at the Times. Two of the major things that I've won have won Pulitzer Prizes. I won a Pulitzer when I was an investigative reporter in New York reporting on conditions for the mentally ill in New York City and residents of the mentally ill in New York City. I won a Pulitzer for that in 2003. And then when I was in Russia, I worked on an extensive series about human rights in Russia that I won a Pulitzer for with a colleague in 2011. And you know, both of those series could not have come about were it not for the dedication of the New York Times to this kind of deep, what we call enterprise or investigative journalism. It's something that the Times is very devoted to, something that the Times believes is its mission. And you know, even in an age when journalism is being very pressed by budgetary pressures, faces a lot of budgetary pressures, the Times has made its a tremendous commitment to this kind of journalism. And I think it shows if you read the Times every day. I mean, there is, on a daily basis, amazing works of journalism that you will find nowhere else. And, you know, they stem largely, or they often stem from the fact that the Times is assigned journalists to do, you know, to do this kind of deep reporting.
Right.
And that's, you know, that costs a lot of money. But the Times cares a lot about this, and the Times believe it's really the mission, our journalistic mission.
Well, let me ask you about two movies. The first one is Spotlight, focused on Boston Globe, and what appears to be a resurgence of interest focus on the value of the kind of investigative reporting you're talking about, different topic, different locale, et cetera. Have you seen the movie?
I have. I saw the movie, and I thought it was fantastic. The news about journalists in the Boston Globe who uncovered this scandal involving the priests and Catholic priests and pedophilia or sexual abuse. You know, I thought the film was extraordinary, and it really showed, you know, what I just referred to, which is this commitment to paying witness to, you know, uncovering the truth, to spending time to really get to the bottom of the story.
Right.
You know, for many journalists, the biggest gift is time. It's just hard to do stories like this in a day or 2 days. It takes many days, weeks, months. And so, you know, in 2016, there are not a lot of journalistic outlets that want to do that. You know, there are a lot of journalistic outlets or organizations that are just devoted to what we refer to as clickbait, which are stories that you can just read in 5 seconds and they titillate you and then you just move on. That's not what the Times is about, or the Boston Globe for that matter. That's not what we're about. We're about doing journalism that really matters.
Okay. Well, thank you. The second movie was Bridge of Spies, and different focus because it looked back at a period in history, and I'm somewhat familiar with the activities around that time. I thought, at least in my sense, it was pretty well done. What was your opinion?
You know, I will admit I did not see Bridge of Spies. I still want to see it.
Okay.
I'm somewhat familiar with that era, and I'm quite fascinated by that era. You know, just coincidentally, I've started watching a series called The Americans.
Oh, yes. Yep. I've seen that. Yes, I am.
Which is quite fascinating as well. And, you know, it's about a couple of undercover Soviet spies who have been placed in American society in the early 80s. And it's quite impressive in kind of capturing that dynamic, that Cold War dynamic between the Soviet Union and the United States, and the kind of all the nuances and gray areas in it.
Right. And I guess the reason why I ask about either one of those is that is in some way what many people are using, whether it's Bridge of Spies as the movie or The Americans as the series, as a way of having a foundational understanding of the Soviet Union at one point or Russia. And the question arises from that to say, is there a way to convey the present state of affairs, or how to extrapolate from watching a series like that?
I mean, I think it's important to understand the history of relations between the Soviet Union and the United States. And I do think it can be helpful in understanding what goes on now. At the same time, I think it's very important that we not overstate the similarities. Russia in 2016 is very, very different than what the Soviet Union was, in part because some of the reasons I referred to earlier, you know, the consumer goods in the society, how much more sophisticated the society is. So I just think it's very important to kind of keep that in mind. I also think the Soviet Union was much more driven by a mission to disseminate communism and socialism and Soviet values around the world. I don't think Russia has that same drive. I think Russia is very protective of what it believes are its interests around the world. And the Kremlin wants to be respected by the United States or NATO or the world at large. But I don't think that the Russia of today is the same as the Soviet Union of the past. And people who make that comparison in too much of a black and white way, I think, are being somewhat simplistic. I think we're at a relatively low point in relations between Russia and the United States, but I don't think it's going to stay this low. I think it will eventually improve. You know, I think Putin is extremely smart. He's a very smart global strategist. But at the same time, he's facing a lot of pressures at home, particularly economic pressures. And I think to some extent, he needs to address those if he wants to stay in power.
Well, that leads, of course, to the last question. Post-Putin possibilities. What happens, because no one lasts forever?
That's true. Although the issue with Putin is it's not entirely clear when he wants to leave. I mean, he came back to office. He can stay in office for a while longer. It's very unclear. I mean, this is obviously a society built, or a government to some extent, out of one man and a kind of cult of personality. It's not entirely clear to me what's going to happen if and when he leaves. I don't think, and anyone who says they know what's going to happen is probably just speculating. I think, you know, I would hope that there would be more of a drift toward a more democratic society that value some of the ideals that are valued in the West, but it's very, very hard to know. I mean, you know, you cannot ignore the fact that Putin is very, very popular right now, and you can not ignore the fact that if he were to leave office, any successor would really be looking at how Putin was able to attain this popularity. And in part, he was able to attain this popularity by, A, ensuring that there were enough consumer goods in society that people remained happy, B, cracking down on dissent, but not cracking down on dissent so much that there wasn't some kind of freedom of expression, and C, you know, exercising Russia's might on the world stage. And, you know, I think he's found he's very smartly, for him, found a way to make all that work and to stay in power. You know, obviously, from an outsider's perspective, or from the perspective of Russian human rights activists, he has a terrible, terrible record. But in terms of his kind of more pragmatic ability to stay in power, he's very gifted at that.
Okay. Mike Malevsky here with Cliff Levy, and we've been talking about his experience, long experience with Russia, and also his upcoming appearance here in Palmer on Sunday afternoon at Fireside Books. We're just about to finish up. Cliff, any last comment?
No, I just want to thank you again for having me, and just let you and all your listeners know what a terrific time I'm having in Alaska.
Oh, great, great. And I'll look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Fantastic.
All right. Take care now. Thank you.